The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And our first item from the Week magazine for this week, September 30th, 2011, is the Palestinian dilemma at the United Nations. What happened? Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas this week declared that he would push ahead with his plan to seek formal recognition of a Palestinian state at the United Nations Security Council. President Obama called on Abbas to abandon the initiative, saying that Palestinians would only secure statehood through direct negotiations with Israel. Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the UN, Obama said in an address before world leaders at the General Assembly. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now. Obama has repeatedly vowed to veto any Palestinian statehood proposal put before the Security Council. If that happened, Abbas could then go directly to the 193-member General Assembly, which could grant Palestine permanent non-member status, like that of the Vatican. There were signs as the week went to press that a showdown could be forestalled. Foreign diplomats told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that Security Council members had secretly agreed to postpone any vote by referring the proposal to a subcommittee for study. Another plan reportedly under consideration would see Abbas deliver a letter to the Security Council seeking full Palestinian statehood without pressing for a vote. A delay would give Abbas and his advisers time to bargain with the U.S. over the terms of the new peace talks. "We don't need a vote right away," said a Palestinian official. "We see this as the beginning of a process." Now here's what the editorials had to say. "Palestinians are right to take their case to the UN," said the London Observer. "During 20 years of peace talks, the space available for a Palestinian state has only shrunk as Israel appropriated more and more land in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It's now up to the international community to decide on the merits of a Palestinian state." "But there's no such thing as a Palestinian state," said National Review. "This wannabe country lacks everything a nation needs, from internationally defined borders to functioning institutions. Its government is also fatally split. Hamas terrorists control half of the territory, while the rest is ruled by Abbas, a former terrorist whose term of office expired 2 years ago. A yes vote at the UN would simply put a fig leaf on a fraud. So why are the Palestinians pursuing this symbolic trinket?" asked the Wall Street Journal. "Because admission to the UN guarantees access to the International Criminal Court, which can issue international arrest warrants for Israeli soldiers. That's a useful tool for Palestinians in their perpetual campaign to harass, delegitimize, and ultimately destroy Israel." Now here's what the columnist said. "Israel has inflicted this wound on itself," said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com. "If Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had picked up negotiations where they left off with his predecessor, Ehud Olmert, the Israelis and Palestinians might have struck a deal by now. Abbas had already signed on to a non-militarized Palestinian state, continued Israeli control of East Jerusalem, and the return of only a handful of Palestinian refugees to Israel. But Netanyahu insisted that Israel could never relinquish any part of Jerusalem or admit even a single refugee, forcing Abbas to head to the United Nations." "Don't blame Israel," said Yossi Klein Halevi in the New Republic. "The Palestinians have twice been offered a state based on the pre-1967 war borders. Their leaders refused to abandon the sacred right of return of all Palestinian refugees to Israel. That is the sacred right to destroy the Jewish state through demographic subversion. Netanyahu's stance, isn't the cause of the peace process breakdown, but it is a result. Whatever happens in the next few weeks, Obama is in a no-win situation, said Laura Meckler in the Wall Street Journal. If he doesn't veto recognition of a Palestinian state, he'll lose support among American Jews, a constituency he needs to win re-election in 2012. And if he does use the U.S. veto, he'll further damage America's lousy standing in the Middle East. But perhaps we should all stop panicking about this largely symbolic vote, said Wendy Chamberlain in Politico.com. If it passes, it will simply make the Palestinians feel more empowered in negotiations with the far more powerful Israel. Would that really be such a bad thing? The next item, Obama's tax challenge to the GOP. What happened? President Obama outlined his plan to reduce the nation's deficit this past week with an unapologetic call for higher taxes on the wealthy. The plan proposes $2.1 trillion in cuts to defense, health care, and non-discretionary spending, and a $1.5 trillion in new taxes on corporations and Americans earning over $250,000 a year. It also includes a special tax on millionaires, nicknamed the Buffett Rule, after billionaire financier Warren Buffett, who has argued that the rich should pay higher taxes. The plan would save the government $3.2 trillion over the next decade and would pay for the jobs bill proposed by the president 2 weeks ago. Adopting an aggressive new tone, Obama warned Congress that he would veto any one-sided deficit reduction bill that cut Medicare benefits without asking wealthy Americans to contribute more. This is not class warfare, it's math, Obama said. The money is going to have to come from someplace. Republicans who have ruled out revenue increases as part of a deficit-cutting deal said that raising taxes on the rich would unfairly target small business owners and job creators. Class warfare may make for really good politics, said Representative Paul Ryan, but it makes for rotten economics. Now here's what the editorial said. It's only fair to ask the rich to pay more, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. The facts on America's growing class divide are irrefutable. The wealthiest 10% reaped 100% of the gains of the past two decades of economic growth, while the other 90% worked harder and longer and saw their income stagnate or decline. Our economy has undergone a dramatic transformation, said the Boston Globe, making tax reform necessary. Government investment in research and protection of intellectual property, not to mention billions in Wall Street bailouts, have helped the financial and tech sectors boom, enriching private equity investors and high-tech businesses. Surely millionaires whose incomes have grown exponentially can afford to kick in more without hurting the economy. But wealthy Americans are already paying their fair share, said the Wall Street Journal. IRS data showed that those who earned $1 million or more in income paid federal income taxes at an average rate of 23.3%, while those who earned between $50,000 and $100,000 paid 8.9%. Warren Buffett's famous charge that CEOs regularly pay lower tax rates than their secretaries is pure Omaha hokum. Obama's proposal isn't tax justice or even good policy. It is all about re-election politics. Now here's what the columnist said. Obama's militant tax hike threats are a sign of desperation, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com. With unemployment stuck at 9%, he's now relying on liberal left class warfare ideology to convince voters that the rich are to blame for their lack of jobs instead of failed Obama administration policies. It remains to be seen whether voters will be taken in by this con job, said Terrence Corcoran in FinancialPost.com. A demagogic class war may not be enough to hide the increasingly apparent failure of Obamanomics. Unfortunately for Republicans, said Derek Thompson in The Atlantic, raising taxes on the rich polls spectacularly well. Americans support increasing taxes on wealthy families by 2-1, according to a Gallup poll, and only 26% oppose raising taxes on corporations. Little wonder the Obama administration wants to turn the 2012 election into a referendum on whether the wealthy have a responsibility to pay more if grandma has to give up some of her benefits. This is the debate it thinks it can win. Say goodbye to the Great Compromise, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. Obama has finally realized the GOP has no interest in a grand bargain and has made him look weak and ineffectual by blocking his every move. So now he's demanding that Republicans raise taxes on the rich while knowing full well they'll pay a political price for refusing. This isn't the conciliatory path Obama instinctively prefers. It is, let's admit it, politics as usual. But having failed to change Washington, the White House must now play by its rules. It's the only option that they have left. And we'll turn to the controversy of the week. In the Week magazine this week, it's entitled Compassion. Should private charity replace big government? Where are the compassionate conservatives? Said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Ever since the Tea Party hijacked the Republican Party, conservatives no longer accept the idea that government has at least some responsibility for caring for the old, the poor, the sick, and the unfortunate. The right now holds a pinched, crabby view of government safety net programs like food stamps and Medicaid, and regards the taxes needed to pay for them as an unfair intrusion on society's winners. So what if cutting government to the bone costs hundreds of thousands of teachers, cops, and firefighters their job? So what if 50 million Americans lack health insurance? That's their problem. For a chilling glimpse into these hardened hearts, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times, consider how the crowd reacted at last week's Tea Party-sponsored Republican debate. CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked libertarian Ron Paul about a hypothetical 30-year-old man without health insurance who suddenly needed 6 months in an intensive care unit. Should society just let him die? Several Tea Partiers in the crowd shouted, "Yay!" to applause and cheers. You couldn't find a more vivid illustration of the fact that conservatism is now a deeply radical movement, for which a lack of compassion is now a matter of principle. Oh, how dreadful we conservatives are, said Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com. How dare we doubt that government can solve all of life's problems? Liberals seem to think that the only legitimate way to help one fellow man is to head down to the polls every couple of years, check the big government box, and go to sleep like a baby. Conservatives have a different view of how compassion works, said Katrina Trinko in USA Today. As Ron Paul told Blitzer at the debate, it's better to encourage people to take responsibility for themselves, and if that fails, our neighbors, our friends, and our churches should step in. And conservatives actually practice what they preach. A 2006 study found that while conservative households earn on average 6% less than liberal ones, they donate 30% more to charity. They also donate more blood and are far more likely to volunteer. So who's really more heartless? How nice it would be if we could just rely on friends and neighbors to take care of the needy, said Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. But private charity cannot possibly provide for the 50 million Americans who lack health insurance, the 45 million who depend on food stamps, or the 15 million who are unemployed. Since you can't pass a hat around the neighborhood to raise a few hundred billion dollars, what should these unfortunates do? Starve? Do without doctors? Die? To see how this debate plays out in the real world, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com, consider the case of Kent Snyder, who was Ron Paul's campaign manager in 2008. Like his close friend, Paul, Snyder was deeply devoted to liberty, but he couldn't get health insurance because of a pre-existing condition, and he fell seriously ill at age 49 and died, leaving his family with $400,000 in medical bills. It's all well and good to say personal responsibility is the bedrock of liberty, but what that really means in practice is denying people like Snyder medical treatment. The other alternative, the compassionate one, is for society as a whole to assume moral and financial responsibility for those who'd suffer or die if we didn't. We are a decent society, aren't we? And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the popular section entitled A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. Well, this week it was a good week for texting, which 55% of young cell phone owners now prefer to voice conversations, according to a new survey. People 24 and under now send an average of 110 texts per day. It was a good week for the Tea Party, a Canadian rock band, after it put its domain name, teaparty.com, up for sale. The band hates Tea Party politics, but analysts say the website address could sell for over $1 million. "We've got families," a band member said. And it was a good week for keeping kosher online after an Israeli computer programmer created FaceGlat, a cleaner version of Facebook for God-fearing Jews. Glat is a strict type of kosher. The new site separates profiles of men and women and blocks indecent advertisements and bawdy entries that would lead to spiritual deterioration. And it was a bad week for first-hand experience after Ronald Wade, 31 years old, applied for a job as a jailer in Warren County, Mississippi. And during his background check, police found that Wade was wanted for DUI manslaughter in Florida. So he was arrested and jailed. It was a bad week for having it your way after an irate customer allegedly returned to a Missouri Taco Bell with a shotgun after discovering that a worker had failed to include hot sauce packets with his meal. And it was a bad week for spending that raise after the superintendents of Stanton, Virginia schools apologized to 31 teachers for accidentally raising their salaries. He blamed the mistake on a combination of human and computer error, and he told the teachers they'd have 24 months to repay the money. And now we'll turn from Good Week Four and Bad Week Four to the People section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item, Ecclestone's Sparkling Life. Tamara Ecclestone wants to make it clear that she's not a spoiled brat, said Carolyn Graham in the London Daily Mail. The 27-year-old daughter of billionaire Formula One boss Bernie Ecclestone and Croatian model Slavica insists she was brought up with a healthy respect for money. "Both my parents came from humble beginnings and were determined not to spoil us," says the perfectly tanned socialite. "I had to work for my pocket money, walking the dog and picking up his poop." These days, admittedly, her parents are more liberal with their allowance. Ecclestone is now house hunting in Los Angeles for something in the range of $160 million. And rumor has it that she recently dispatched five minions to the Amazon basin to search for white rock crystal that will be carved into a designer bathtub for her $70 million London home. Surely this is a tabloid fantasy? "No, it's completely true," she says, shrugging at the $1.5 million price tag for the tub. "I've got to reinforce the floor, and I've had to pay for everyone's travel and the hauling back and polishing of the crystal. But I spend a lot of time in the bath, so it's worth it." And now the next item is the Shakespeare of reversible prose. Barry Duncan is locked in an epic struggle with the alphabet, said Gregory Kornbluh in The Believer. Ever since he picked up a book on wordplay in 1981, Duncan, who is 53, has been obsessed with writing palindromes, words or sentences that read the same forward and backward, like the famous "a man, a plan, a canal, Panama." "I write hundreds a day," says the recently unemployed bookstore clerk. His complex compositions often run up to 1,000 characters long and tackle big issues like climate change. You shouldn't confuse me with any of those garden variety Madam I'm Adam hacks. Duncan follows a strict set of guidelines when writing. One cardinal rule, don't double up letters. Straw warts, that's a palindrome. But the W is doubled, so it only calls attention to the palindrome. His proudest achievement is a 406-word creation that he wrote on commission for an eco-friendly boutique in Cambridge, Massachusetts. One of the piece's lines, Go Ecotopia, is reversed to read in part A IPO to CEO. Despite such playfulness, the life of a master palindromist is a lonely one. None of his friends share his passion, and several stop talking to him after he sent them his first book of reversible prose. People think it's freakish. Palindrome writing is not the way to win friends and influence people. And the next item from the People section, Gosling's outsider art. Ryan Gosling has always been an outsider, said Tom Schoen in the London Telegraph. Growing up in the small town of Cornwall, Ontario, he struggled to fit in at school and picked fights with tougher kids in a bid to impress his classmates. It didn't work. I lost them all, says the actor. Deeply lonely, Gosling sank into his own imaginary world. In first grade, he turned up at school with a bag full of steak knives after watching the Sylvester Stallone movie Rambo First Blood. I threw them at one of the kids in recess. He was suspended, and soon after his mother started homeschooling him. I had no pals, none, Gosling thought things would change when at age 12 he moved to Orlando after being cast alongside Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake in the Mickey Mouse Club. He was quickly disheartened. I wasn't nearly as talented as some of the other kids. Relegated to bit parts, he spent his spare time wandering through Disney World alone. It made a huge impact on me, Gosling says. I love the idea that Walt Disney had this dream and then made it a reality. I want to be that kind of person. And now we'll turn to the briefing section of the Week magazine for this week. This particular item is entitled Requiring an ID to Vote. Are tougher state election laws an attempt to stop voter fraud or a stealth campaign to disenfranchise Democrats? What do new voting laws require? Seven states, all but one of them governed by Republicans, have passed laws this year requiring voters to show a photo ID at the polls. The new laws in Alabama, Kansas, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Wisconsin are similar to ones already on the books in Georgia and Indiana. GOP lawmakers in as many as 24 more states hope to adopt legislation mandating photo IDs for voters before the 2012 elections. Republicans say the new measures aim only to prevent voter fraud, but Democrats see them as a part of a concerted campaign to suppress the vote of students, minorities, and legal immigrants, groups that generally favor Democratic candidates. Why are these laws being introduced? Republican lawmakers say their long-standing concerns about voter fraud were exacerbated during the 2008 elections. Some conservatives believe the community organizing group ACORN deliberately registered thousands of illegal voters under false names and then encouraged them to vote for Barack Obama. While investigators haven't found evidence that illegal voters registered by the now bankrupt organization actually cast ballots, a number of ACORN regional officials and workers have since been convicted of election fraud. The controversy sparked a GOP crusade to ensure that people turning up to vote really are who they say they are. A simple requirement that a voter demonstrate his authentic identity assures that free elections remain untainted by fraud, said Hans A. von Spakovsky, a former member of the Federal Election Commission. How big a problem is voter fraud? It depends whom you ask. Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas and the GOP's leading voice on voting reform, says electoral fraud occurs in all 50 states. In Colorado, he says, authorities found 11,805 illegal aliens on the registration rolls, as many as 4,947 of whom voted in 2010. Democrats counter that the problem has been vastly overstated, pointing out that the Justice Department convicted only 86 people of voter fraud between 2002 and 2007. There is independent evidence, however, that some fraud goes undetected by authorities. A 2004 investigation by the Orlando Sentinel found that 1,650 Floridians voted twice in 2000 or 2002. And the New York Daily News discovered that 46,000 people were registered to vote in both New York and Florida in 2004, and that as many as 1,000 of them actually did so. Could fraud affect elections? It doesn't take much. Al Franken of Minnesota won his Senate seat in 2008 by just 312 votes. And George W. Bush won the presidency in 2000 by a margin of 537 hotly contested votes in Florida. The Commission on Federal Election Reform, chaired by former President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker, concluded in 2005 that even the smallest occurrences of fraud could have significant repercussions. There is no evidence of extensive fraud in U.S. elections or of multiple voting, said the report, but both occur and it could affect the outcome of a close election. Why do the Democrats object? They say voter ID laws discriminate against poor people, young people, and minorities. One in four black Americans does not possess any form of government ID, according to New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, and many foreign-born Americans lack the papers, such as a birth certificate required to obtain a driver's license or a state ID. Texas accepts gun licenses as proof of identity, but not student IDs, making it harder for college students who voted 2-1 for Democrats in 2008 to cast their ballots. To get a free ID in South Carolina, voters must first pay for either a birth certificate or a passport. Representative John Lewis, who is a Democrat from Georgia, a veteran of the civil rights movement, called the raft of new laws a deliberate and systematic attempt to discourage millions of poor and minority people from voting. If the 2012 presidential election is close, cutting the turnout by such voters could tip the outcome to the GOP. And there is evidence that some conservatives do hope that voter ID laws will suppress electoral turnout by legal voters. In a piece on the conservative blog American Thinker earlier this month, blogger Matthew Vadim said it was un-American to let the poor vote. The poor can be counted on to vote themselves more benefits by electing redistributionist politicians, Vadim said. Registering them to vote is like handing out burglary tools to criminals. So are voter ID laws like a poll tax? Like a poll tax, voter ID laws will undoubtedly discourage some people from voting, and most of them will be young, poor, or racial minorities. But that doesn't mean voter ID laws are illegal or unconstitutional. In 2008, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court validated a voter ID law passed in Indiana, ruling that requiring such IDs has become commonplace in public life. Justice John Paul Stevens, then the leading liberal on the bench, wrote that visiting the local Department of Motor Vehicles to obtain a photo ID does not qualify as a substantial burden on the right to vote. The Carter-Baker report made the same argument in 2005. Photo identification cards are currently needed to board a plane, enter federal buildings, and cash a check, it said. Voting is equally important. And the footnote to today's briefing entitled Requiring an ID to Vote, it's entitled Stop Rocking the Vote. Get Out the Vote groups are now getting a hostile reception in many states. In 2004, voter registration drives run by nonprofit groups such as Rock the Vote and the League of Women Voters signed up 10 million voters, many from traditionally disenfranchised groups, among them the disabled, the poor, and minorities. But the Acorn controversy has prompted a widespread crackdown on any such efforts. In Florida, for example, anyone who signs up voters must submit the registration forms to the state within 48 hours or face possible felony prosecution. GOP lawmakers say the legislation will stamp out fraud, but the League of Women Voters, which has decided to stop registering voters in Florida, calls it good old-fashioned voter suppression. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. The first one is entitled, Capitalism is Killing the Middle Class, by Christia Freeland in the NewYorkTimes.com. No one in Washington is talking about America's most fundamental economic problem, said Christia Freeland. That problem is income equality, the growing chasm between the wealthy and the middle class. The top 1% of earners now take home more than 18% of national income, a startling increase from 1973, when the richest share of income was 7.7%. Why is so much wealth being concentrated at the top? Few like to admit it, but globalization and technology have triggered an economic revolution that's hostile to the middle-class majority. Our new economy benefits a fairly small class of people, those who run companies, technologists, engineers, and Wall Street traders, whose salaries have soared. Meanwhile, jobs that once sustained the middle class, from manufacturing to a growing number of white-collar jobs, can be done more cheaply by machines or workers in India and China. As Republicans and Democrats battle over less important issues, this is the elephant in the room. Someone needs to admit that modern capitalism isn't working for the middle class and find a way to make it work better before it is too late. The next column is entitled, Who Are You Calling Stupid? And it's written by Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Are Republicans stupid? Asked Kathleen Parker. Democrats certainly think so. That's the only way they can explain the popularity of GOP presidential hopeful Rick Perry, a self-confessed terrible student who jokes that he was in the top 10 of his high school graduating class of 13, or the election of George W. Bush, who once boasted that anyone, even a straight C student like himself, could grow up to be president. This reverse braggadocio is mysterious to Democrats who revere Ivy League educated intellectuals. Many of their book-smart politicians, like President Obama, have little experience outside of politics and academia, but nevertheless assume that experts like themselves can solve all problems. Stupid Republicans, meanwhile, have more faith in average Americans, who may not have Ivy League diplomas, but nonetheless are self-reliant, individualistic, and entrepreneurial. In an ideal world, our president would have both a well-read mind and plenty of real-world experience. Until such a candidate arrives, my money is on the stupid politicians who are dumb as foxes and happy as clams when their opponents misunderstand them, or rather misunderestimate them. And the next column is entitled, Buying Local is Bad for the Planet, written by Charles Kenny in Foreign Policy. If foodies really care about the future of the planet, said Charles Kenny, they should give up buying local and shun organic food. The first world food fetishes of the Whole Foods crowd aren't always good for the environment, and they hurt the world's poor. Locally grown food often takes more energy to produce than food imported from the third world, especially when it's out of season. It's far greener to import fruits and vegetables from South America and Africa than to grow them in energy-intensive hothouses during a North American winter. Organic farmers, meanwhile, get 8% less food out of their land than conventional farmers, and in eschewing chemical fertilizers, use tons of manure from energy-consuming livestock. That's why organic produce is far more expensive. So the more land we give over to lower efficiency organic production, the more expensive all food becomes. Bad news for the 1 billion people worldwide who are malnourished. If you really care about the planet, forget being a locavore and become a cosmovore, a cosmopolitan consumer of food from everywhere. And now we shall flip to the back of the magazine, for the Week magazine for this September 30th, 2011, and we'll take a look at The Last Word, very popular two-page column at the end of this magazine. This week's title is Human Sacrifice. Despite rising concern about brain damage, says Paul Solotaroff, linebacker James Harrison hits hard and high. At his home in Scottsdale, Arizona, James Harrison disappears down the hall to get dressed. The Pittsburgh Steelers defenseman is remarkably short for a bull rush linebacker, barely 6 feet without socks and cleats, but marvelously carved for a man of 250 pounds. He comes back in a Nike tee and black mesh shorts that cover his shins. It's the get-up he'll sport for the next 3 days, wearing it to steakhouses where men in Brioni stare at him in pique, and to jewel box bistros where ladies who lunch glower at him over lobster salad. Harrison makes just under $9 million a year and has closets full of handmade, brightly colored suits that he wears when the mood arises. But in lily-white Scottsdale, he couldn't care less about the feelings of the local swells or their custom of donning socks to dine in public. "My world, my terms," his outfit announces. Harrison is the scourge of the National Football League's vexed campaign to check concussive tackles. He is the man who seized Vince Young and dunked the Titans quarterback, all 230 pounds of him, headfirst into the turf like a crueler. This is the man who knocked two Cleveland Browns cold in the span of 7 minutes last year, and then baited NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell with his post-game comment saying he'd like to hurt opponents. In Arizona, he is up at first light 6 days a week, running in hot sand pits and doing backward hurdles after giant leg press sets. But he is back at home by 10 a.m., and that leaves the rest of the day to text and tweet and seethe over last season's insults. The fines, the flags, his branding as a thug, then try his soul long after the fact, trailing him to his posh but desolate place where even the air burns and crackles. "My rep is James Harrison, mean son of a bitch who loves hitting the hell out of people," he says. But up until last year, there was no word of me being dirty till Roger Goodell, who's a crook and a puppet, said I was the dirtiest player in the league. If that man was on fire and I had to urinate on him to put it out, I wouldn't do it. I hate him and will never respect him. When he's not ranting, which he does much of the time, Harrison has timely things to say about violence in the NFL, and he will consider, however tersely, the effect of all those hits upon himself. And that, more than anything, more than the grudges, the name-calling, makes Harrison worth listening to. As far back as 1960, when Chuck Bednarik, the cement mixer linebacker of the Philadelphia Eagles, almost beheaded New York Giants flanker Frank Gifford with a blindside shot at midfield, we've indulged a certain hypocrisy regarding pro football's gilded mayhem. We know that players we've loved and lived through are damaged by the collisions, but we don't wring our hands or click the games off, as we've largely done with boxing. Lately, though, it's gotten a lot harder to ignore the fallen or to pretend that they bounce back up. The 2010 season shattered all records for on-field concussions and season-ending shears of soft tissue, including 261 documented concussions, or almost 30% more than in 2008. One weekend last October, dubbed Black and Blue Sunday, there were 11 men concussed. The same day that Harrison iced the two Browns, though neither hit was flagged by officials nor looked, through the prism of slow-motion replay, like a deliberate attempt to injure. Nonetheless, the league had a riot on its hands. The football press erupted that week in righteous indignation, screaming something must be done. Harrison, who had never been fined more than $5,000, was charged $75,000 for his knockout hit on Cleveland receiver Mohamed Massaquoi. Football, as Harrison plays it, has always been a crucible of force on force, big men bleeding for every yard, with the winners being the ones going the extra step, hitting harder, training longer, dying younger. The game lives by a code in which honor and pain are words that describe the same thing, and while the league belatedly is thinking long and hard about how to protect its players, there's no protecting them from themselves, at least by Harrison's lights. I get dinged about 3 times a year, and I don't know where I am for a little minute. But unless I'm asleep, you're not getting me out of the game, and most guys feel the same way. If a guy has a choice of hitting me high or low, hit me in the head, and I'll pay your fine. Just don't hit me in the knee, because that's life-threatening. How am I going to feed my family if I can't run? If you've been wondering why players hit higher than they used to, there's a good reason, as any. A concussion is, on average, a one-game injury, according to numbers kept by the league. But a torn medial collateral ligament is a season or more, and the NFL is the only major sport that refuses to guarantee contracts. Stack up the far-off prospect of brain damage against avoided $30 million, and most players will roll the dice. Guys tackle high now and are taught that way. We're not going to change that up because you say so, says James Ferrier, the Steelers' inside linebacker, a 2-time Pro Bowler himself. If you're aiming higher, though, you're leading with your head, which courts the risk of helmet-to-helmet hits. But the Steelers don't want their players letting the runner have forward progress. Says Harrison, that's what we've been told by Coach LeBeau. Blow through the guy, not to him. When the fines came down, he said, don't change a damn thing. You're doing it the way we do it on this team. For the past 4 years, Harrison has embodied that ethos. He was the Defensive Player of the Year in 2008 when his numbers across the board, 16 sacks, 101 tackles, and 7 forced fumbles, were freak show good, and he might have won the trophy again last year if his back hadn't seized and cost him power. He's a half foot shorter than most of the tackles trying to block him, but gets tremendous leverage from his hips and quads, a drivetrain like no one else his size. He's weight room strong, but super strong in games, a lower body with insane amounts of pop, says Steve Sanders of Powertrain Sports, Harrison's fitness guru in Pittsburgh. Combine that with his upper body, he benches 500, close-gripped, and James can move guys anywhere he wants. Oddly, he was the quiet one of 6 brothers and 7 sisters, speaking to almost no one outside the family and sleeping with his parents till he was 12. James was my baby, a mama's boy, says Mildred Harrison, who, with her husband, James Sr., a retired trucker, still live in the house in Akron, Ohio, where she raised her kids on a diet of love and sternness. Wielding a belt that she called Black Beauty, my mom would come to school and whip us in class, says Harrison. She successfully saw each of her progeny through high school and on to stable jobs and college. Most of them settled within 5 or 6 blocks of her and travel en masse to Harrison's home games. I haven't missed one in 8 years, she says. After he started as a pro in 2002, Harrison was cut 4 times in the span of 2 years, and he was ready to chuck the game and set about earning his trucker's license. Then he caught a break, Clark Hagans, a Steelers linebacker, broke a hand while lifting weights, and Harrison got one last invite in 2004. He came to camp burning to learn the blitzes and stayed up nights turning flashcards over and scribbling play cues on his wristbands. Harrison made the team as a special teams monster, crushing kickoff returners with pile-driving shots. You have to YouTube. But the Steelers made him wait 3 years to start and thought so little of his long-term prospects that they took linebackers with their top two picks that spring. Properly insulted, Harrison came out blazing. He was named the team MVP that 07 season and the league's best defender the following year, and he became the highest-paid linebacker in history in 2009. He hasn't looked back since, except in anger. There's a river, he reckons, of people that want to cheat me. When Harrison gets going on one of these runs, there's no telling where he'll end up. He can be biting and baiting on a wide range of subjects. Ask him at your peril his views on gay marriage, which make Glenn Beck sound squishy. His position on spanking, he's for it, and how. His two young sons should try handing down fines. And if you ever get him going on gun control, better whip out your Kevlar notepad. But then, without prompting, he'll turn on a dime and offer a sober position on player safety, saying the league should trim the season to 14 games, begin off-season training activities in May, not March, and cut training camp down to just a couple of weeks of one-a-day practices, not two. That way, he says, we're not banging heads so much in August that where's the brain trauma comes from. Oh, he says it comes from the training session in August. He's right about that, and Harrison, for all his bluster, isn't heedless of the facts or the effect of all those hits on his long-range health. When you hit a dude hard, you feel it too, and the Steelers go at play to die speeds. But if, God forbid, I wind up having brain damage, so be it. He has 3 years left on his handsome contract, and if he's lucky enough, he says, to finish that out, he'll quit and turn to his new passion, real estate. With his partner, a veteran developer named Tom Janitas, Harrison is building off-campus housing at two colleges in West Virginia and has already put together an impressive portfolio with many more units to come. Harrison talks avidly about future projects and amassing his own fortune, then buying a jet to show his sons the world, taking them wherever they have running water. But for now, at least, Harrison's probably said enough. He doesn't need invective to make his point that he plays a savage game and that any attempts to childproof the sport will be met with fierce resistance. The players are so big now, so fast and so fit, that no fines, however stiff, or threats of suspension can keep them from hurting one another. At some point in the future, the keepers of the kingdom will have a decision to make, either drastically rewrite the sport's DNA, outlaw tackling above the waist, say, and impose weight limits, or watch it die in flames like ancient Rome. For now, though, these men are our gladiators, and horrified or not, we throng the Colosseums, hoisting two thumbs merrily in the air. This article was copyrighted 2011 in the Men's Journal and was first published there. We read it with all rights reserved. It was distributed by Tribune Media Services. And now we'll turn from the last word to the talking point section of the Week magazine for this week. And our first item is entitled HPV Vaccine. Should it be mandatory? Michelle Bachmann has proved that she suffers from breathtaking ignorance, said the Washington Post in an editorial. At last week's GOP presidential debate, the Minnesota congresswoman scored some points with an inflammatory attack on Texas Governor Rick Perry's since-overturned executive order that all girls in the state receive a vaccine against the sexually transmitted human papillomavirus, which can cause cervical cancer. Perry, Bachmann said, had tried to force a government injection on innocent little 12-year-old girls. The next day, she went totally off the cliff by asserting in a national TV interview that the HPV vaccine called Gardasil can cause mental retardation. For a presidential candidate to engage in this kind of anti-vaccination nonsense is wildly irresponsible and could sabotage the ongoing campaign to protect women against HPV. Perhaps Bachmann will also now object to mandatory vaccinations for polio, chickenpox, mumps, measles, and other infectious diseases. There's a big difference between those diseases and HPV, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. They are easily transmitted through the air, casual contact, and routine classroom interaction, which is the only reason we grant the state the power to require vaccination. HPV is transmitted only through sex, and there are plenty of parents who would choose not to have their children vaccinated out of a conviction that it would undermine the parents' encouragement of abstinence from sex. Simply put, the state should not be encouraging sexual promiscuity by socializing its cost. HPV may not be easily catchable in gym class, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, but from 50% to 75% of Americans contract this nasty little virus at some point in their lives. HPV causes virtually all of the 12,000 new cases of cervical cancer and 4,000 deaths each year. A widespread program of mandatory vaccination could slash those numbers dramatically. As a Christian and a parent, I find it astonishing that anyone would suggest that HPV and cancer should continue to serve as deterrents against engaging in premarital sex. And what of the woman who remains abstinent until marriage and then contracts HPV from her unknowing husband? Vaccines work only if the entire population receives them. That's how epidemics like HPV are eliminated, and why the decision to vaccinate is not purely personal. Perry may have been heavy-handed in mandating the HPV vaccine, but it's Bachmann who's truly guilty of moral confusion and public health illiteracy. Our next item, Palin, an author's venomous portrait. I never thought I'd say this, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com, but I feel sorry for Sarah Palin. Even a vapid publicity hound like her does not deserve the trashy hatchet job author Joe McInnes does on her in his new unauthorized biography, The Rogue. Relying heavily on anonymous sources, McInnes dredges up lurid tales of sex, drugs, and dysfunction from Palin's past, including a supposed one-night stand with basketball player Glenn Rice, an alleged affair with her husband's business partner, and the charge that she once snorted cocaine off an oil barrel. What happened to Joe McInnes? Asked Janet Maslin in the New York Times. His 1969 debut, The Selling of the President, about Richard Nixon's re-election campaign, is a classic of diligent political reporting. The Rogue, however, is nothing but caustic, unsubstantiated gossip that finds the once-respected political writer too busy being nasty to be lucid. Palin's sex life doesn't interest me, said Eric Wimple in the WashingtonPost.com. But hypocrisy is a quality that must be exposed in our political leaders, and Palin opened the door to this kind of intimate revelation with her outspoken support for abstinence-only sex education. The fact that Palin herself indulged in hanky-panky before marriage perfectly illustrates why it's wrong to deny young people information about sex and birth control. The same goes for the drugs, said Tony Newman in HuffingtonPost.com. Palin likes to pretend she's tough on crime, so she's part of the political system that currently jails 500,000 Americans for nonviolent drug offenses. If she, like an ever-growing group of elected officials, once used illegal drugs recreationally, she should be exposed as a phony. If Palin were still Alaska's governor or had joined the presidential race, said Matt Latimer in the DailyBeast.com, those arguments might hold some water. But her poll numbers have plummeted, and even most Republicans have written her off as a viable candidate. So there's no defense for the sexist glee with which McInnes tries to destroy Palin's character. Not only does he try to prove she had sex with a black guy, he takes great pains to portray her as a lousy mother who was too busy with her narcissistic climb to fame to feed the kids. Is anything in this book true? who cares for McGinnis and the millions of Americans who have loved to hate Palin these last 3 years? It really is time to move on. And now, as we reach the end of our reading of the Week magazine for this week, let's take a look at a few of the shorter items here from the Talking Points section. After 2 decades of war and civil conflict, about 1.5 million Iraqi women, 10% of the country's adult females, are widows, a new study says. Nearly 60% of these women lost their husbands in the violence that followed the 2003 U.S. invasion, and most are desperately poor. The number of U.S. infants suffering abusive head trauma rose sharply after the recession started in 2007, a new study found. Researchers said the increase in abuse suggested that parents stressed by economic anxiety were lashing out at their crying babies. The next item, the key components of the new San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, including a mile-long cable made up of 137 steel sinews, were manufactured by China. By outsourcing much of the work abroad, the state says it saved $400 million. The number of methamphetamine users in the United States dropped by more than 50% from the years 2006 to 2010 to 353,000 people, according to a new federal study. The number of cocaine users also decreased from 2.4 million to 1.5 million over that same period of time. The number of marijuana users, however, grew from 14.4 million to 17.4 million. And some items from the Wit and Wisdom column in the Talking Point section of the week. Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul, said Edward Abbey, quoted in the Village Voice. You will not become a saint through other people's sins, Anton Chekhov, quoted in the Weekly Standard. A great truth is a truth whose opposite is also a truth, Thomas Mann, quoted in the Associated Press. And now for the poll watch for this week. Hillary Clinton is now the most popular national political figure in the United States, with 64% of Americans saying they have a very favorable or mostly favorable opinion of her. 34% say the country would be better off right now if Clinton were president. 47% say it would be about the same. Only 29% say things would be better if John McCain were the president today. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope that you have enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.